Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Hiring is challenging, but there's one place you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. And growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. Quotable co-founder Gretchen Huebner experienced how challenging hiring can be after unsuccessfully searching for a new game artist to grow with her education tech company. But then she switched to ZipRecruiter and saw an immediate difference. And you can too by signing up for free at ziprecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you, it finds them for you. And by using ZipRecruiter's screening questions to filter candidates, Gretchen found it easier to focus on the best ones than find the right one. In fact, after posting her job on ZipRecruiter, Gretchen said she was honestly surprised she found qualified applicants so quickly and hired a new game artist in less than 2 weeks. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com, ZipRecruiter.com/MURDER. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Sexual predators exist in our society, and their evil desire leads them to commit heinous, brutal crimes with little concern for their victims or the toll it takes on the community. Violent sociopaths have no interest in the needs or safety of anyone else and see ordinary people as either targets or competitors. They have no hesitation taking what they want from their victims. Whether they are rapists, pedophiles, or murderers, these monsters will do whatever it takes to get their needs met and their evil desires satisfied. Captain Dean T. Olson, retired, is a veteran sex crimes detective with the Douglas County, Nebraska Sheriff's Office, serving the Omaha area. In his 30-year law enforcement career, he has seen some of the most horrible crimes committed by one person against another, and he has arrested some of the worst sexual predators the nation has ever seen. The book that we're featuring this evening is Evil Desires, The Recollections of a Sex Crime Detective, with my special guest, detective and author Dean T. Olson. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Dean T. Olson.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. This is an incredible book with your experiences as you commanding the Criminal Investigation Bureau of the Douglas County Sheriff's Department in Omaha, Nebraska, and you retired after 30 years in 2008. You have 3 other books, Perfect Enemy, Tactual Counterterrorism, and The Omega Confluence. Now, you were a sex crimes detective, as we mentioned, and obviously the focus of this book is rape and murder. In the beginning of this book, you take the reader through the categories of rapists before you get to these extreme, graphic, and incredible tales that show examples of these rapists and the characteristics that you outline. As you do in the book, can you tell us a little bit about the categories and what they entail of these rapists?
Yeah, it's interesting. Back in the mid to late 70s, the FBI started doing some serious research into the categories of rapists. Their ultimate goal was to try to provide law enforcement officers, detectives, with information that would help them narrow the universe of suspects so that they could focus their investigative efforts more efficiently. And eventually they came up with essentially four categories: the power reassurance rapist, the power assertive rapist, the anger retaliatory rapist, and the anger excitation. So essentially two power type rapists and two anger type rapists. And the characteristics associated with each helps the detective to determine which category the rape they're investigating fits into, so they can focus their investigating efforts more closely on identifying a suspect instead of grasping at straws and looking at everybody that might be involved in such a crime.
Now, you provide an example of an incredible case, March 31st, 1986, and a farmer found a body of a boy named Ricky Chaddick. He would have been reported missing March 23rd, 1986. You get this call, and your partner, fellow detective, what is the process? What do you do first? You get the call. Tell us, take us through what happens next.
My partner on that day was Dave Van Solik, and a really good investigator. And we had worked together for so long that we didn't need to talk. We could read each other's movements and our thoughts, almost like reading each other's minds. But that morning I was in my office returning phone calls, and Dave and I were backup investigators. They had a big task force organized at Omaha Police Central Headquarters. I think there were 60 investigators working nonstop 24 hours trying to find Ricky Chaddick. These type of cases are very emotional. They hit a community very hard. So people were phoning in a lot of tips, you know, thinking, well, maybe this tip will help. And a lot of times those tips, they're not all that good. So they would take what they considered the prime tips, the best tips, and give it to the lead investigators, the more promising ones. And lesser quality tips, they would funnel to Dave and I as backup investigators and other backup investigators at other agencies as well, to free up the prime investigators, the lead investigators, to focus on what they consider the more promising tips. And at the beginning of an investigation like that, it is pretty much a mess. You're just grasping at straws, trying to flesh out the details of the case. And in that process, you have to look at everything, because if you overlook one thing, it might be the thing that is important. So they would take the promising tips, focus it to the lead investigators. The less promising ones, they would send off to backup investigators like me and Dave. That morning I was in my office returning phone calls and looking at some tip sheets I had. I was going to go work right away. When my lieutenant came up, and I was on the phone at the time, and he kind of patiently stood by my desk, and I knew he was in a hurry. So I finished the phone call, and he said, "You need to get out to 168th and Ida." At that time, a rolling farm field on the west end of the city, and he said the farmer found a body. So Dave and I headed out there. We arrived, the patrol deputy was there, and the farmer was there, and he was pretty upset. In those days, there weren't any cell phones, so he had been out to his field. He'd seen a body in the ditch and kind of backed by some trees a little ways off the road. And he knew enough not to approach the body so that he would contaminate the scene. He went home in his truck, contacted or called 911. The patrol deputy showed up, and the patrol deputy was smart enough to follow in the farmer's footprints or foot track back to where the body lay. Once he got close, he could see that there was a presence of lividity, which is a purplish brown, looks like bruising, but it's not. That indicates that the person is deceased because the blood pools in the lower portions of the body. Once the patrol deputy had seen that, he knew he didn't have to approach, that there was no resuscitation, and the child was already dead. So he backed out, took the farmer back out the same way they walked in. So when Dave and I got there, we knew immediately that we approached the same way, walked in the same footprints again. So we minimized the contamination of the scene, could see the lividity. So immediately we called the crime lab out, and they sent out four people in a big mobile crime lab van, and took hours to check the scene and then remove the body for an autopsy down at the morgue, which I attended the next day. And you can tell quite a bit from the condition of the body, the condition of the crime scene. It gives you tips about who the offender might be or what type of category of murderer or rapist that he fits in. I say rapist because even though a victim, a body, may not show any obvious signs of sexual assault, it doesn't mean the victim hasn't been assaulted in some way. But in this case, I can't give a lot of information because it's still considered an open case, and we have what's called holdback information that you don't release to the public because it could jeopardize the investigation or tip off a suspect that you're looking at them, that type of thing. So I can't talk with a lot of detail, but the child had been fed. He'd been missing 4 or 5 days. He'd been fed. He'd been kept. He was clean. There were no obvious or overt signs of sexual assault, but again, it doesn't mean that he wasn't. And from the contents of his stomach, they knew approximately when he had last been fed and things like that. But from that, the FBI uses that information, the crime scene, the family history of the child and the child's age and things like that, and they can prepare a profile that helps you narrow down the universe of suspects that you're looking for.
You include a case because of a murder of Danny Joe Eberle, 13, who
right.
disappeared while delivering newspapers. What is your connection to this story as you write in the book? And tell us about this story that you've included. Why was this
essentially, my connection, well, it hit close to home for me because Danny Joe Eberle was the first of two victims in Nebraska that was abducted and killed by, I can't think of his name off the top of my head.
John Joubert?
John Joubert. He was an Air Force airman stationed at the local Air Force base down in Bellevue, Offutt Air Force Base, which at the time was a sprawling Air Force base. It's quite a bit smaller now, but it was the home of the Strategic Air Command. Danny Joe Eberle was taken, and then a while later, a young boy named Christopher Walden was taken. And what really hit close to me was that Christopher Walden was kidnapped two blocks from my home on his way to school, the same school that my son attended, my son and daughter. So it hit really close to home because it was right there.
You were assigned to the patrol division at that time when Walden was abducted. What other things did this – you talked about 100 officers on that case. And also that rules have changed in some of these cases. I don't know if they were the precedent for those changes, but when one of these children went missing, the parents didn't find out till the end of the day. So rules have changed as a result of these crimes in these cases, haven't they?
Yeah, that's true. In fact, when Christopher Walden disappeared, his parents had no idea that he didn't show up at school because in those days the school wouldn't call. Well, now I don't know of a single school that doesn't call if a child doesn't show up and say, hey, is so-and-so excused for the day or, you know, what's the status? And it's directly as a result in the Omaha area, especially of the John Joubert serial murder cases.
Yeah. You were talking about the search for, well, eventually what they found out to be Joubert, but there was no suspects in the case, and you talked about a guy that you say that a unique breed, a dying breed, a Sheriff Thomas had an idea to use the media, but it was controversial. The FBI didn't agree with him. Tell us about this idea and what it did result in.
Well, I actually saw the case. Thad Thomas was a old school sheriff in Sarpy County where the two abductions had occurred, and as an executive, he was standing back and letting his assigned people do their jobs, which is what his job was. He didn't meddle, but he was involved in every aspect of the case, but he would stand back and watch. And after the Walden abduction, the second abduction, he approached the task force and he said, hey, we're not getting anything done here. We got kids being snatched. He said, how about I get on TV and I'm going to appeal to this guy, turn yourself into a priest. You don't need to turn yourself into me. And he said, I'm going to taunt him. I'm going to ask him, why are you picking on kids? Why don't you pick on an adult, somebody who can defend themselves? And the FBI was just adamant, no, you can't do that, because if another kid gets taken then because you irked this guy or in some way, it's going to come back on the task force and we're going to be blamed for it. And that's a legitimate concern, but Pat Thomas was not to be dissuaded, and he said, no, he said, I'm going on TV tonight, and he did. And it turned out to be the thing that precipitated the arrest, because John Joubert reacted just the way Pat Thomas said he would. He saw the TV thing because he was watching the progress of the case in the news, which Pat Thomas also realized. He said, I think this guy's watching us in the news. He's watching our newspaper reports, our TV reports, and seeing how close we're getting. And Joubert watched the broadcast and was just infuriated that Pat Thomas had said, you're not a man because you're attacking kids. Why don't you attack an adult? So the very next morning he did. He went out and attacked a woman, an adult, and she was able to get away from him, called police, gave a license number of the car he was driving, and that ultimately led to his arrest.
It was interesting, too, you include a famous criminal profiler from the FBI, Robert K. Ressler, and you include, and this has happened before, where he provides a profile and you say this thing was useless, but inadvertently it led to another murder being connected. Can you explain that? Interesting story.
Yeah, Ressler's, and again, you know, a lot of times they don't have a lot to work with. Generally, they like to have at least three serial cases because then you have enough information to provide a more accurate profile. But in the case of the Joubert, he was working off the first case only, and he was way off on some things. Like he believed that Danny Joe Eberle, the first victim, had been kept for a while by his killer, which wasn't true. We hadn't found his, or the task force hadn't found his body yet, which is the only reason why the body hadn't turned up. But Ressler's profile was pretty much not helpful at all. So general and generic to the point of being useless, but he came back and revised it when Walden was taken, and it was a little more accurate, but still didn't play a big role in the case. The case was solved by Pat Thomas. And Ressler, though, he studies all this stuff because he's trying to perfect his craft. And in the process of studying the Joubert case, because of the two killings in Omaha, he realized he was talking to a group of National Academy cops at the FBI Academy in Quantico. And he mentioned the cases in Omaha and the specifics, and an officer there was from Maine. And he said, you know, I've got a case that sounds just like this case. And they started looking into it, and sure enough, that was Joubert's first kill when he was a juvenile, a 16, 17-year-old kid in Maine.
Yeah, incredible. And you provide that whole background, too, his development and evolution as this eventual serial rapist killer.
Yeah, what's significant about Joubert is that the sexual aspects of his crime were more involved with the sadistic, the torture. They call it piquerism, the stabbing. Biting is also a form of piquerism. It's a sexual aspect, a masochistic or sadistic torturing of the victim for the pleasure of the murder. Neither Danny Joe Eberle or Christopher Walden had been sexually assaulted in an obvious way, but the piquerism, the bites, and the stabbing and things like that indicated that it was a sexual crime. And so that was significant because to a layman or a cop that doesn't have a lot of experience or hasn't been through training, you would look at that saying, well, this guy just likes to stab kids or he likes to bite people. I don't see a sexual aspect to it, when piquerism is a sexual sadist's way of inflicting torture and pain and suffering on a victim.
Yes, absolutely. It's you write that he had the death penalty imposed and he was executed in July 1996, and Sheriff Pat Thomas died in 2010 at 70 years old and had retired at 65. Let's talk about a case where you earned your first award for rape investigation, and that's the Earl LaBelle case. You call it a hot prowler rapist. Can you tell us what hot prowler refers to?
A hot prowling case, either rapist or burglary, refers to the fact that the burglar or the rapist likes to go into a house while people are sleeping. It's considered hot prowling because he picks a house specifically because he knows there's going to be people inside. In the case of rapists, a lot of times it's a sexual turn on to be able to skulk around inside in the dark as people are sleeping, as they're slumbering. In the case of Earl LaBelle, one case in particular where the victim's husband woke up when he was standing next to the bed on his wife's side. She normally doesn't remember her dreams or didn't remember her dreams, but that day when she was awoken or woke up abruptly because her husband yelled, there's a man in here, she remembers that dreaming of somebody standing next to her with his hands near her face. So Earl LaBelle was sneaking around in the dark looking for things to steal and also for victims to rape if he stumbled upon a vulnerable woman. And in the process, he was considered a hot prowl burglar slash rapist. But it was an interesting case from the standpoint that a patrol deputy actually made the case for me, because I had received the information that they had a hot prowl case down there, and I knew that sometimes hot prowl burglars also indulged in rapes. And I knew that neighboring jurisdictions down there had some rapes, but I didn't have a rape case in my jurisdiction at the time. Subsequently, a couple of weeks later, I had my first rape victim, and the MO was the same. A woman had gone to bed at 10, 11 o'clock at night. She was a very light sleeper. Her daughter was visiting from out of town. She left the front door unlocked. And this Earl LaBelle was an experienced burglar. He'd been arrested as a juvenile, so he knew that if he carried burglar tools to pry into a building, he could get arrested just by having those in his possession. Plus, they could be matched up to tool marks on the door that he pried or whatever. So he knew in a big apartment complex, a lot of people just forget to lock their doors or they don't lock them at night. And the area that he was prowling was a fairly relatively crime-free area, so people were nonchalant about locking their doors. Well, in this case, the woman's daughter was visiting. She didn't have a key, so she left her front door unlocked sometime in the middle of the night. Then 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning, she hears the door open. Light sleeper, she wakes up. She yells out to her daughter, doesn't get a response, and so she thinks, okay, she didn't hear me. She yells out louder. Well, then suddenly she's starting to get scared because her daughter's not responding, and suddenly she sees a shadow moving down the hallway towards her bedroom, and the shadow's illuminated by the only light that's on in the apartment in her hallway. Well, she panics because she can't go anywhere. She's in bed. She's trapped. Suddenly, he appears in the doorway with a bandana over his face, jumps her in bed, flips her over, and puts a pillow over her head and starts punching her through the pillow and basically beating her up. He was a anger retaliatory type rapist that he was picking on females and using them as a surrogate victim for perceived wrongs that he had suffered at the hands of another woman, maybe a boss or girlfriend, mother, whoever. You know, you don't know the specifics, but beat her pretty good. And in the process, she was an excellent witness. I don't know how these people do it, these victims. Without victims like that, I would never be able to make a case. But she noticed that he's wearing these weird gloves. They were like a fishnet. And he's an experienced burglar, so he knows not to leave fingerprints. Well, she said, look, I've got money in my book, my paperback book next to the bedstand. There's money in my purses. Take what you want. Please don't hurt me. In the process, then, he reaches over for the book, and he can't get the pages thumb through to find the two $20 bills in there because he's wearing these gloves. So he takes a glove off. Well, she's watching him, even though she's got a pillow over her head. She can see out the side. She sees him lay his hand on the nightstand. So he gets the two $20 bills. Well, about the time that he's in the process of raping her, the daughter comes home. He's locked the front door again, so she can't get in. So the daughter's pounding on the door. Well, he panics, and the victim is smart enough to say, my daughter and her boyfriend are there, even though the daughter didn't have a boyfriend. She wanted him to think there was a man in the hallway. LaBelle gets up, dresses himself, and then heads for the patio door and climbs down the second floor patio to the first floor, and then he's gone. But in the process, she had seen that he'd touched his hand to that nightstand. So when I talked to her in the hospital, she said, yeah, I said, is there anything that you saw, you know, where I could might identify this guy? Did he touch anything? And she said, well, he had these weird fishnet gloves on, and I'll come back to those gloves in a minute. But she said, yeah, he took those gloves off, and I think he touched the nightstand. So I called the crime lab guys who are still at the scene, and I said, look, do that nightstand very closely. I said he might have touched his fingers or palm to that nightstand. Well, in most cases, when a suspect is brought in, they take what's called pen print cards, fingerprints only. They don't do the palm prints. But luckily for me, we had a really good cop named Gary Kirkle. I changed his name in the book because I don't have permission to use his name in the print. But he's patrolling one night when LaBelle is doing his hot prowling, and he gets what most midnight cops think is a dream call. He's got a hot prowler in an apartment, and he's a block away. He's literally across the street from it. He shoots across the street. He sees a stocky black male running south from the Citadel apartment complex. He turns and tries to chase him down in his car, but he disappeared in the Wentworth apartment complex, which was just south of there, a big sprawling metropolitan apartment complex with a lot of garages and cars to hide behind. So he hangs back and he waits and has another car go to the scene to talk to the victim. In the process of waiting there, he sees a car drive through real slow and sees it hit its brake lights a couple of times. As he sits back with his lights off, he sees that same stocky black male run from between two garages and get in a car. Pulls the car over, and in it is Earl LaBelle on the passenger side and his girlfriend. He hauls them both in, impounds the car, and in the process of talking to Earl LaBelle, he says, look, he said, can we take your fingerprints? And Earl says, we already got them. He says, well, can we take your palm prints? Now, why he was smart enough to ask for palm prints, but that's a sign of a good cop. He went the extra mile.
That's right.
He took Earl LaBelle's palm prints, and he didn't have enough to make a case on the hot prowling case where he was in the apartment when the man woke up and chased him out of there. But when I got the rape case later then, I went back to the crime lab and they said, do you have a suspect that we can look at? And I said, well, I don't have a prime suspect, but I said, I would start with Earl LaBelle. And one of the crime lab guys had remembered him and said, yeah, he was in here a couple of weeks back. I said, yeah, I would start with him. Went back and started doing my thing. You know, this crime lab stuff isn't like on TV. It takes hours and hours of tedious work. Went back to my desk, and I was doing things and making phone calls, and the crime lab guy, Bill Caulfield, came running in. He says, hey, he said, I made the palm print on Earl LaBelle on your rape. I said, well, tell me about it. So he says, I got a right palm print on the fingerprint lift that was taken off of the nightstand. He said, it's a partial, but he said, I got 10 points of identification. Well, then I had my suspect because how his palm prints got in there could only be one way. He had to be in the apartment. And from there, I made cases against him for the rape of, I changed her name to Kosiski. But anyway, I made that case. And then a neighboring jurisdiction also had a rape, similar MO. They weren't making any headway, and I called them and asked them if they wanted me to assist them with it, and they said, well, we'll get back to you, and they got tied up with other cases. The victim in their case read that I had arrested LaBelle in a newspaper, and they called and said, the victim called and said, can you work our case for us? And I said, I can't. I said, it's not my jurisdiction, but I said, I will call that jurisdiction. I'll talk to the chief and see if I can assist them. And she asked me, she said, do you think it's the same guy? I said, yeah, I'd almost bet it's the same guy. I called the chief, and to my surprise, he said, yeah. He says, please feel free to work it. We don't have a suspect. We'll give you anything you need. So I talked to the victim, and he had worn a blue bandana, so she wasn't able to make an ID from him. But it came to me in the process of talking to her that she was a very resolute and smart witness. I called her up and I said, you can't identify this guy because he wore a bandana. I said, could you recognize his voice? And she said, yeah, I think so. So I said, if I get recordings and play them, would you think you'd be able to recognize his voice on a recording? She said, yeah, I think so. I said, well, do me a favor, write down four or five phrases that he said exactly, and then I'll meet with you and we'll prepare basically a transcript. And I'll see if I can, you know, get the sample, and then you can listen to it. And if you identify somebody, fine. If not, we'll keep going some other direction. Got the voice exemplar, played it. She identified the guy immediately. They had five other voices on there, and she had no doubt it was him, and made the case on him for the second case. But it was a very unique case. I don't know of any other case that's been solved in Nebraska history based on a voice exemplar, voice ID.
I'd never, as I mentioned before the interview, I'd never heard of anything like that, and I thought this was just the most incredible story of utilizing this body warrant to be able to do something like this. And at first, you say that that he's very hesitant. The perpetrator, LaBelle, is very hesitant to do this, but then he submits to it. You talk to his lawyer, and you, can you explain that again, why it was the duty of his lawyer to be able to honor that warrant?
Sure.
When I went down to the correction center where LaBelle was housed at the time on my previous arrest for the palm print, I had the transcript with me and a tape recorder, and I sat him down and I said, look, I've got a body warrant here to get a voice sample from you. I showed him the warrant, gave it to him. He read it over, and he said, I'm not going to do it. And I said, well, you don't have a choice. I said, the judge has signed it. I said, here's the transcript I want you to read. And he goes, that's some racist bullshit. I said, no. I said, the other voices are also black. He said, who are they? I said, well, one's a black police officer I know, a couple of black deputies, and a black city prosecutor. He said, I'm not going to read it. And as he read the transcript, he really got upset. You could see him getting visibly upset because he realized that my victim, from the neighboring jurisdiction's case, had nailed him. I mean, she had his phrases down pat. And then he just threw everything on the desk. He said, I'm not going to do it. So I handcuffed him, put him in my car, drove him two blocks north to the courthouse where I just gotten the body warrant signed and brought him before the judge. The judge told me, he goes, look, he says, the guy's already in jail. He said, the statute doesn't have a lot of teeth in it to force compliance. He goes, I don't know what a contempt citation would do for the guy. He's already in jail. He can't post bond. So, you know, he'd basically be spinning your wheels. I can't force him to give you the voice exemplar. So I thanked the judge. He took the LaBelle back down to the correction center, dropped him off. And I had seen on his papers from corrections that he had a defense attorney named Don Klein. Well, Don Klein was a former prosecutor who had left the prosecutor's office and went into private practice. And I knew Don from prior cases that I had worked with him. So I called Don up and I said, hey, look, I've got a body warrant on your client. I need a voice exemplar, and he's refusing to give it to me. And he said, okay, what's the docket and page number on the warrant? So I told him, and I said, look, I gave LaBelle a copy of the warrant. He basically crumpled it up and threw it away. And I said, I need you to tell him to comply with this. You're an officer of the court. Could you do that for me? He goes, yeah, no problem. He said, I'll talk to him later on today. If I don't call you back tomorrow morning, he said, give me a call. I'm kind of busy with other cases, but he says, I'll get him to comply. So he went down, he talked to his client, LaBelle, and corrections, and he said, you got a body warrant. It's legitimate. I can't tell you not to do it because I'm an officer of the court. There's a compelling reason to give it because the judge has signed it. You need to give it to him. I called the client up the next morning because I was anxious. I wanted to get it done. And he said, yeah. He said, I talked to him yesterday. He'll give you the sample today. Went back down there again, and the guy was dragging his feet, but I just stayed with it. It took about an hour and a half to get him to convince him to do it. And he balked at some of the more damaging or incriminating comments that he had to read, but he ultimately gave it to me. And once I had that, then I took the samples out, had the victim come in from the other jurisdiction, and she picked his name out of that, with essentially a voice lineup of one suspect mixed in with four or five other people. Interesting case.
Now, to add to this interest, though, it looks like all these heroic efforts and have resulted in this, you know, would-be conviction here. What is the monkey wrench in this whole deal here? What happens?
Well, the weakest case, obviously, was the voice identification because there's no fingerprints. There were no eyewitnesses. She couldn't identify him. And the defense attorney was going to make a big deal out of the fact that she couldn't identify him because he wore a bandana, which is understandable. They have to vigorously defend their client. So I lost track of the case because I was working other cases, and I seldom went to court to watch a trial unfold because I just didn't have the time. So I didn't pay much attention, and I didn't realize that the prosecuting attorney decided that he would arrange a plea bargain for LaBelle because my fingerprint or palm print case was so strong that LaBelle would plead guilty to that, essentially one count, and they would drop the count for the victim from the other jurisdiction that made the voice identification. Well, she was in court with her husband and was just furious because the prosecutor didn't tell her that that was the case. Now, what the prosecutor did was, as part of the plea arrangement, he said that even though he's only pleading to one case, the palm print case, I'm going to enter into court for sentencing that he's also accused of a second crime, second rape. And that case while a strong case of not being prosecuted, it's part of the plea arrangement. But that way the judge will know when it comes time to sentence that he's actually involved in two rapes instead of just one. Well, to the victim sitting in court, it sounded like her case wasn't important because they dropped it. So I get a phone call from her and her husband hours later, and they're visibly upset. And I don't blame them. You know, you can understand where they're coming from. And the husband got on the phone. He goes, I can't believe this. You know, my wife goes through this, and you did your job, and the prosecutor fell down on his. And they said, well, let me call and find out what the logic was. And I called down and talked to the prosecutor. I said, look, you know, how about telling these people what's coming so they're not blindsided like that? Well, I kind of understand where the guy's coming from because he's also got a heavy caseload. But I said, you know, these people felt that they weren't important enough for justice to be served for them. He goes, well, that's not the case. And I said, well, can you call them? Well, no, he never did. But the bottom line is I told him, I said, here's why. And I said, the bottom line is when he comes up for sentencing in about 6 weeks, I said, he'll be sentenced for essentially two cases, yours and the other one. I said, so he's not getting off scot-free. And I said, it saves your wife having to get on the stand and testify against him and being cross-examined, which is an unpleasant experience sometimes in those cases. The interesting note on this case is that Earl LaBelle, yeah, he was just released from prison like 2 years ago. He was the longest serving inmate that I had in prison. He must have been a discipline nightmare because he should have been out much earlier. But he's out, and hopefully he's old enough now where he's aged out of reoffending because he's a dangerous individual.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is Ritual. We all want to do the right thing to keep our bodies healthy in the long run. But even if we try really hard to eat kale salads and drink green smoothies, we're still most likely not getting all of the essential nutrients we need on a daily basis. Enter Ritual, the obsessively researched vitamin for women. Ritual's essentials have the nutrients most of us don't get enough of from food, all in their clean, absorbable forms. No shady additives or ingredients that can do more harm to your body than good. Two easy-to-take capsules provide 9 nutrients you need to support a strong foundation for your health. My wife, Lisa, decided to take Ritual about 12 weeks now. She especially appreciated the amount of research that Ritual did to create their Ritual vitamin. And she feels very confident about their claims because she thinks Ritual has made a difference in her everyday activities. From D3 to omega-3, Ritual's essential for women helps fill gaps in a women's diet. Their no-nausea capsule design is gentle on an empty stomach, and there's a mint tab in every bottle to keep things fresh so you don't get that fishy aftertaste common with most omega-3s. A subscription is easy to start, and it's easy to snooze. It's only $1 a day to have all the essential nutrients your body needs delivered every month, no strings attached. Better health doesn't happen overnight, and right now Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off during your first 3 months. Fill in the gaps in your diet with Essential for Women, a small step that helps support a healthy foundation for your body. Visit ritual.com/murder to start your Ritual today. That's 10% off during your first 3 months at ritual.com/murder. Now, Dean, we were talking about your incredible book, and as it progresses, the examples of the 4 categories of rapist become even more extreme, more interesting, but far more disturbing. One of the most disturbing cases I've ever read about is this Thomas Red Nesbitt, a member of the Omaha chapter of the Hells Angels Motorcycle Club. You talk about, not to get too far into it, but you describe some of the behavior of these outlaw motorcycle members, but you refer to a term called sweeties. Tell us what sweeties is and introduce this Thomas Red Nesbitt and what type of rapist category he falls into.
Nesbitt was a member of the Omaha chapter of the Hells Angels. For those who do not know, the Omaha chapter was the first Hells Angels chapter organized outside of California. It was the first extraterritorial chapter that the Hells Angels established. So there's a long history there. It's originally the chapters were in California only, but as the gang started to grow and expand, Omaha became one of its first chapters outside the state. They had a concept. They viewed women as property and chattel. Sometimes they would trade women like they traded motorcycles. And Nesbitt was an anger retaliatory type rapist. He viewed women as property, that they owed him sex whenever he wanted it, and if he didn't get it, he would beat him up to take it, and there was no remorse, nothing like that. And the concept that the angels operated under were that women in a bar, that if a guy wanted a woman to grab her, take her home and rape her against her will, snatch her off a bar stool or whatever, they called them sweeties. They were women that were brought to parties or tricked into being alone or secluded where an angel could rape them. And the sweeties term was an ironic term, obviously, because they weren't sweet. Nothing sweet was going to happen to them. They were going to be victimized. And in the case of Mary Kay Harmer that I write about in the book, she was tricked into coming to one of the angels' houses in Carter Lake, which is a city actually in Iowa, but it's on the adjacent to Omaha. And Nesbitt had a girlfriend at the time, and he said, call up some of your high school friends and tell them you got a housewarming party and invite them over. And of course, it was a trick to get innocent young girls there to the house where Nesbitt and his neighbor, Wayne Bieber, who was also a Hell's Angel, could attack and rape them. So the girlfriend contacted some friends, and Mary Kay Harmer was one of the girls, and she thought she was coming to a party with high school friends and didn't realize that it was all a setup for her to be. She was a sweetie. It was all a setup and was going to be raped, and because she fought back and was probably going to call the police to report the rape, Nesbitt decided to kill her.
You talk about the involvement of this woman named Ray, and this is Nesbitt's, as you say, old lady. Again, despite the threat of Hell's Angels, tell us, as you write in the book, about Ray and why on earth and how get in the crosshairs of the Hell's Angels.
Well, there's a lot of psychological processes underway with women that decide to hook up with these angels. Sometimes it's low self-esteem. Sometimes they've been victims of sadistic men in their past, raped or abused by loved ones, father, husband, whatever. But essentially, they cling to an outlaw biker like a Hell's Angel because it provides them with security and maybe a little bit of self-esteem and some prestige in a sick sort of way. She was attracted to the lifestyle because, for one of those reasons, I don't know, I've never really talked to her about it, but the bottom line was that she was attracted to that, and she worked three or four jobs so that Nesbitt could not work and basically was shiftless, would lay around the house and do dope and drink and ride his motorcycle and steal and thieve and sell dope, and she paid the bills because she was one of these beaten women who kissed the hand of her abuser just so he would pay attention to her from time to time. I think at the time she had three jobs, and Nesbitt didn't have any job, and she paid all the bills while he could hang around with his gang buddies.
So you have that is in terms of that night, she and another friend, again, the old lady of this Wayne Bieber, they are ordered to go pick up these sweeties. They are asked to invite their friends, to lure their own friends to this party. At first it was this Jorgensen was scheduled to go, but she changed her mind. So unfortunately, this Harmer was interested in the drugs that was promised to be supplied there. Now, Ray and this Bridget are... It's an incredibly disturbing story because you have that this Bridget is concerned that her old man is having sex with this woman that they're going to rape, so that she's going over to this house next door trying to interrupt what she believes is just her husband being adulterous rather than the horror that's actually being perpetrated on this young girl. Eventually, this woman has to go to work, so she has to go into the house. What does this lead to in terms of this person, Ray, and what does she do as a result of all of this?
Well, as you say, she had to go to work, so she finally forced her way into the house, and she saw blood on the floor and went into the bathroom, and Nesbitt and Bieber, the Hells Angels, were in there, yelled at her to get out of the bathroom, and they said, "Did you see her?" Well, the shower curtain was pulled, so she claimed that she never saw anything, but what they had done is they're smart enough to know that they contain the mess. If you're going to kill somebody, you do it in a bathtub where you can wash down the after effects of a killing in a drain. So she says she never saw the body, but the shower curtain was pulled. She got yelled at to get out of there, so she did, but she saw blood in the kitchen, saw blood other locations in the house, and said that she had to go to work, so she left, having, to her recollection, never, her claim, had never seen the body. She got home that night after working and found out that the house had been thoroughly cleaned with bleach and sanitized, and all of the bed linens had been washed, and some carpet had been torn up and was now missing from the floor, and she didn't realize it at the time, or claimed she didn't realize it, but Bieber and Nesbitt had rolled up Mary Kay Harmer's body in that carpet and had carried it next door to Bieber's house and hidden it in the garage, because they knew that eventually the police were going to come to the house looking for Mary Kay Harmer. So sure as heck, that day then the family gets notified by Jorgensen, Harmer's roommate. Harmer never came home. So they called the police. It was the sheriff's department, because the place where she lived was outside the city limits at the time. Detectives went to the location and asked permission to search. And, of course, Nesbitt had nothing to hide, because he knew full well that Mary Kay Harmer, the victim, was next door, rolled up in a roll of carpet. They had stripped her, washed her body, cleaned it, and burned her clothes. Bieber had burned her clothes in a burn barrel in the backyard. Detectives searched the house, didn't find anything, obviously, and went their way. And then she was missing for 9 years. What had happened was they found a manhole, unused manhole, about half a block away from the house in an industrial area that wasn't built up. Dumped her down there, poured lye on her with the mistaken assumption that it was going to dissolve things, and it didn't. And essentially her family suffered for 9 years not knowing what had happened to her, had no word of where she was. The two old ladies from the Hells Angels weren't talking for obvious reasons. They were afraid. But Nesbitt and his girlfriend fled Omaha. They moved to Chicago and changed their name because they were worried, obviously, that the police were looking at them. And Bieber and his girlfriend, they fled. They ended up in the suburb of San Diego. And then, of course, when the body turned up, then the heat started again, because now they had a crime for sure, because they had the body with what looked like two bullet holes in the head, and it opened the case again. The body was found by survey crew. Yeah, the survey crew popped the manhole, and to their surprise, there was a skeleton in the bottom. Obviously, they called the police right away, processed the scene, recovered the body, and started checking missing persons. And we could tell, you know, from the nature of the body that it was a female, early 20s, late teens, and right away, my captain at the time, Tim Dempsey, who had worked the case as a young detective, he said, "This could be Mary Kay Harmer, because the Hells Angels houses are like 100 yards from this manhole.
Wow.
Would have been a good place to dump her in the middle of the night. Nobody would see him, that type of thing." Yeah. In the process, or in the meantime, Red Nesbitt, the killer, had fled to South America. He used his Hells Angels connections to get a phony passport under a last name of Stein. I think it was Michael or Thomas Stein. He fled to Brazil, and him and his angel buddies down there helped the Brazil Hells Angels get their chapter started down there. Well, after a while, he got tired of living down in Brazil, so he came back to Chicago area where he's originally from, using the phony passport and the phony name, and promptly started cooking meth. Well, the DEA had a clever sting going at the time. They would monitor bulk purchases of the chemicals, the precursor chemicals, used to make meth, and if they noticed that people were buying these, they would conduct an investigation to see if these people were in the process of using these chemicals legitimately, or if they were in the process of manufacturing meth. And they set this company up in Chicago called North Central Interstate Chemicals or something, which the abbreviation for the word of the company was NCIC, which is ironic because that's also the name of the computerized system that held the warrant for Thomas Nesbitt for murder. Flipping back a little bit, after the body was found, then they got a warrant for Nesbitt. Couldn't find him because he was in Brazil, obviously, but eventually came back home and had a phony name, and he'd been told by other angels that the body had been found, so he was laying low. But he couldn't resist cooking meth, and so they started ordering chemicals from NCIC, a chemical company, and they had a chemist for DEA would look at the orders and extrapolate from the purchases what quantity of meth was being produced and that type of thing. So they started surveilling the people that were buying these things, and it turned out that one of the people involved in the purchase was a Brazilian woman named Anna. I don't remember her last name. And Thomas Nesbitt, De Silva, and Thomas Nesbitt's brother. They followed him to a house in Indiana, kind of a suburb of Chicago, set up a surveillance and arrested them and said, who's the cook? Who's the chef? And they said, well, it's Mike Stein. Still using Nesbitt's alias. They talked to the owner of the property. He said, I rented this to a guy named Stein. And no, I had no idea what they were doing with the property, but, you know, I rent a lot of properties, and his name was Michael Stein. They didn't have anything out of Michael Stein because it's a fictitious name. So eventually they ended up arresting Stein. They found a lot of chemicals, a lot of meth in the house, and they booked him under the name Stein. Well, the next day in court, he came clean. He goes, no, I'm Tom Nesbitt. He said he might be looking for me for murder in Omaha, and that's how they linked him to the case.
And what was the result of all of that
conviction? He stood trial. He stood trial and got convicted. He didn't have money for an attorney. He claimed he didn't anyway, so one of the best criminal defense attorneys in town is head of the public defender's office. He defended him. And he was convicted. He's filed four, maybe five different appeals and lost each one, sentenced to life in prison without parole. So he's going to die behind the walls in the state penitentiary in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Deservedly. Let's talk about one more incredible case, the Christina O'Day rape murder. You call it the babysitter killers. And you say this is by far the most brutal, well, a judge in this case said it was by far the most brutal murder trial he's ever heard. Tell us about this killer and what type of rapist this killer is before we talk about Christina O'Day and Martha Bouchon.
Yeah, Christina O'Day was a young high school girl. A friend of the family needed a babysitter to watch a young child, 6 years old, I believe, at the time, because the mother was recently divorced or was no longer married. I don't know if it was a divorce or death in the family or whatever, but the mother was working nights, and so she needed somebody to come in and babysit in the house overnight while the child slept and get the child up in the morning to go to school. The mother knew this O'Day family and trusted them, and so she hired Christina to come into the house every night, Monday through Friday, spend the night there, get the child up in the morning, feed her, dress her, get her off to school. Well, Christina O'Day knew a couple of guys and from high school. One of them was no longer attending high school. The other guy, she didn't know, but he had worked with this, trying to think of what his name is, Garza. Knew this Garza kid from high school. Garza had dropped out of high school, and he knew that Christina O'Day was spending the night in his house, so he came over to the house one night, but it was a night that the mother happened to be home, so he was basically told to leave. The mother didn't, Marsha Bouchon, the mother didn't think too much of it. She basically said, well, who's at the door at 10 o'clock at night, and Christina Odesa, some kid named Michael Garza. And why was he here? Well, he knew me, and I told him he couldn't be here. So the mother basically chased the kid away. The next night he came back, 2 o'clock in the morning, with a guy named Wayne Brewer that he met while they both were working at a Kentucky Fried Chicken at on the west end of town. They broke in, Garza broke in, and cut the phone line at the back of the house, went in the house supposedly to steal things to pawn so he could get money to pay his car insurance. But once he got in there, he let Brewer in through the front door. Of course, Christina O'Day and the six-year-old girl are sleeping. They have no idea. He goes upstairs. He wakes up Christina O'Day, ties her up, strips her naked, ties her to the bed, puts a gag on her, and beats her, and then rapes her and sodomizes her. He goes down and he ridicules Wayne Brewer, who didn't want anything to do with the rape. Brewer goes up and he assaults her, rapes her. And then Garza decides he's going to kill her because he can't leave a witness. In the process, the young girl, the six-year-old, had awakened, and he went into her room with Christina O'Day by the wrist, holding her by the wrist, and said, tell her it's okay. It's, you know, to calm down. We're going to be leaving soon, and please go back to sleep. So the little girl went back to sleep. Garza got a 12-inch butcher knife from the kitchen and basically stabbed, cut Christina O'Day so she bled to death. He piled up some items like a VCR and some other items he was going to steal by the front door. He had taken a door closer, hydraulic door closer off the front door, and had beat her with that. So the assault was very, very brutal. In the process, Christina O'Day bled to death, and then Brewer and Garza and Brewer, when they fled, they didn't even bother taking the items they reportedly went in to steal. But the next morning, the little girl got up. She heard the alarm going off in the room, looked inside, and saw her babysitter laying there, and was scared to death. So she went to a neighbor's house and said, I think something bad has happened to my babysitter. They called 911. The patrol deputy showed up and realized they had a homicide. That's when the case started.
It's interesting, and it's horrifying to realize that, and as you bring the reader in, that the girl is runs from home to home and nobody answering that doorbell, and then finally she's there seeing the horror and listening to the babysitter being tortured and raped and assaulted. So how did the police get to find out about Wayne Brewer and Garza?
Well, we first thing you do is you talk to the people closest to the victim, and in this case, her mother, and also the mother of the six-year-old girl. And in the process, she said, well, there were two boys here at the house last night or a couple nights ago, and she described them as Wayne, or not Wayne, but Garza. And so with that name, then they were able to look at him as a possible suspect. They went to where he worked, and they said, who does he hang around with here? And they said, well, he works with a guy named Wayne Brewer. So now they had the other name. Started looking for these two kids, and in the process, Garza went underground. He fled. His family was actively hiding him. And Brewer, to his credit, his mother said, I'll bring him in to talk to you. Brought Brewer into the sheriff's department headquarters and sat him down and started interviewing him, and eventually he confessed, and that's when we had the details of the case, because he said, yeah, it was me and Garza, and we'd gone in there. Garza broke into the back window and basically laid out the whole sequence of events with in graphic detail. Brewer at the time was 18, so when he got sentenced to life without parole. But Garza was 16 or 17 at the time, so they had a Supreme Court ruling that came up a number of years ago, so he had to be resentenced because they said it wasn't fair to a juvenile to sentence him to an adult sentence because his brain wasn't fully formed, and so they had to resentence him.
It was concerning for the family, but he did receive a sentence that essentially will his first parole date might be when he's 65 years old, and that's just eligibility. So that's just eligibility.
Right. That doesn't mean he'll get out. But yeah, the judge in the case, Burkhart, had seen a lot of murder cases in Omaha. So he had presided over a lot of murder cases. He made the comment. He said this was by far the most brutal murder case he'd ever seen, and for us who had worked it, been to the autopsies and been to the crime scene and stuff, we concur with that. It's needlessly brutal, and again, part of that sadistic thing where you beat somebody beyond, they call it expressive rage, or you have utilitarian rage, or the type of stab wounds, for example, that will kill a person. You stab them two or three times, then you stop. But when you have somebody that beats somebody with a door closer and gags them so they can't breathe, and then cuts their wrists so they bleed to death and stuff, that's overkill. And that's a sign of the sickness of the person that's committing that crime.
It was interesting, too, and fascinating when you talk about the mother bringing him in. They both came in eventually with mothers. It's always the mother.
Yes.
But he came in with the mother, and first he denied it. But then the mother, he had a talk with his mother, and she basically said, Tell him what you did. Tell him what happened. And later she tried to defend her son from the death penalty, but it's very interesting that you got to watch that as detectives questioned Brewer.
Yeah, I was watching through the two-way mirror, and it was interesting because the mother came up and said, look, I need to talk to him again. We agreed that he would come in here and tell you everything he knew, and let me talk to him again, because one of the detectives had gone to her and said, look, he's not cooperating with us. Can you help us out? And she said, we need to know what happened. And she said, yeah. And he said, we agreed on the way down here that he was going to come in and tell the truth. So she went in, and with the detective sitting there, she said, Wayne, you know what we talked about. You were going to come down here and do the right thing and tell these people what happened. So after that, Wayne Brewer, his shoulder started to slump. He leaned forward. You could tell he was resigned to giving up the information. And then ultimately he confessed and explained exactly what happened, who was involved and when, and what they did afterwards. And in the ensuing days after he was charged, he actually called detectives back a number of times and took them to different spots where they had thrown things. So he assisted for quite a few days. And then eventually when the mother and the family learned exactly how serious it was that he was facing the potential death penalty, she changed her mind and said in court that, no, they coerced him, they tricked him, and, of course, he was on tape, so it was pretty hard to prove that he'd been tricked or anything. But, and that's understandable. The mother's trying to defend her child.
Sure. Yeah, certainly. You had to attend Christina O'Day's autopsy. Again, very difficult, wasn't it?
Yeah, I've been to a lot of autopsies as a detective. That's a stock and trade. That's one of the things you do is you go to the autopsy. But to see a young girl there in the prime of her life with all the potential that youth holds, and to see there's such a needless waste, it really bothered me a lot.
You talk about, too, that Michael Garza, his brother and his cousin were all convicted of attempted rape before Christina O'Day's murder. So it was, at least the mindset was among family members and relatives, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I heard that his father was in a prison in another state for sexual assault also. So there's some family dynamic there too, because the brother was involved in a rape. Michael Garza was involved in a rape murder. The father reportedly was also a rapist, and so you've got something going on. That just doesn't happen. There's some dynamic there impacting that family, and it's hard to say if it was the father or something else, but that's not normal.
You have a part of the book you call the conclusion. What can you tell us that you can conclude after 30 years of service and experience with, again, as we mentioned, some of the most heinous psychopathic rapist murderers in the nation? What do you conclude?
Well, I conclude that it's lucky for us that they're a very small percentage of the population, but the damage they do, or the potential for damage that they can do, is beyond imagination. I had people tell me that after they read the book, they had trouble sleeping, nightmares, that type of thing, because I get pretty graphic in it. I want to explain to the reader exactly what these victims go through and the horrors that they face. But I guess the thing to remember is that these people walk among us. They look just like you and I. They're sociopaths, and they have no conscience, no empathy for anybody else. And, you know, if they get a chance to use you for some purpose, they will without batting an eye. And sometimes they're violent. Oftentimes, a lot of serial killers are sociopaths. And the potential for damage that they inflict on society is horrendous. And people need to be aware of the fact that they don't look like monsters. They look like you and I.
You also talk about the language. It was fascinating throughout the theme of this whole book is that almost every type of rapist in those categories use the same kind of language of I won't hurt you if you comply. I otherwise I'll kill you if you don't do what I tell you. Is the lesson in most of these cases to comply was a good idea?
Well, it's difficult to say, because if you resist a power reassurance rapist, the least violent of them, they will generally flee, because their fantasy in committing these rapes doesn't include violence. So if you start to destroy that fantasy by resisting or fighting back violently, suddenly the reason for committing the rape, the power and control, the fantasy involved, disappears, and so they'll flee. They'll find somebody who's not going to resist. But the danger is, if you try to resist an anger excitation rapist like Thomas Red Nesbitt, the Hell's Angel, he'll just overcome your resistance with more resistance, potentially rising to the level of lethal violence. He doesn't care. I mean, he's going to take what he wants from you, and if you fight back, he feels entitled to overcome your resistance by whatever means necessary. And of course, if you have the misfortune of running into an anger excitation rapist, the sadistic rapist, he feeds off of the fear and stuff. So, you know, you fight back in that case, you're probably going to be doomed, because he's going to inflict as much pain and suffering on you as he desires, because that's what he's into it for. But also in the process, his ultimate goal may be to kill you as the ultimate form of control, because some of these guys have actually choked a person to the point where they pass out and then revived them to, again, choke them to the point of near death and then revive them again, because that's the ultimate turn-on for him. It's that suffering that he feeds off them. But, you know, people need to be aware there are people out there, dangerous, evil people, and they walk among us. You can't spot them because they don't have horns sticking out of their head, or they don't have a big red E on their forehead for evil.
Yes, absolutely. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about Evil Desires, The Recollections of a Sex Crime Detective. It's been fascinating. Dean, tell us how they might take a look at this book. Is there a Facebook page or an Amazon page? Tell us about that.
There is an Amazon page under authors, under Dean T. Olson. Also, the book is at geniusbookpublishing.com. But if you go to Amazon and you type in Evil Desire, or even Dean T. Olson, it'll come up. I think it's a fascinating read, only because what I try to do for the reader is lay out the gritty, nasty details that people don't see on TV, because I wanted them to be aware of what these poor victims go through. And hopefully they'll find it as interesting as a lot of people have told me they found it, and maybe they can learn something about the evil that treads our existence in the process.
Absolutely. It's a fascinating book, and you take the reader absolutely inside all of these horrible details and in the minds of these psychopathic rapist murderers. It's a fascinating book. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about Evil Desires, The Recollections of a Sex Crime Detective. Thank you very much, Dean T. Olson. You have a great night.
All right. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you. Good night.